Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
Looking at this article that has the 10 playoff losers and their chances of winning the Super Bowl next year. I don't know if you've looked at this, Seth, but I kind of hope you haven't. The 10 teams that have lost in the playoffs so far, where do you think the Texans rank among those 10 playoff losers as far as their chances of winning a Super Bowl next year?
Well, based on their odds going into the playoffs, I'm guessing that they are 9th.
They are 8th.
8th? Okay.
Who are they above? They are 8th.
They're above the Bills?
They're above the Bills, who they beat.
Okay.
The Bills are 10th.
Yeah.
The Bills are 10th. The Titans are 9th.
Oh, that's interesting. Oh, good.
Do you feel better about the Texans or the Titans next year?
I would have put the Texans above the Titans anyway. I'm surprised that I felt like the kind of the going narrative would be, oh, wow, look at the Titans.
Nationwide.
They developed into a really good team. Now, I think Tannehill's going to be better than he was in Miami, but I think he's also necessarily almost a scientific fact that he's going to come down to earth a little bit.
Yes.
We've just seen this so many times where players have an 8-game splurge, especially with a new system or when they're rookies or what have you, and then teams have an entire offseason of work to figure out, okay, this is what really worked for him, this is what didn't, this is what we're going to... It's like one big mass experiment among NFL defensive coordinators to figure out, okay, how do we tear down this SOB quarterback?
Right.
And everybody tries a little bit of different. It's like a group effort. Like, oh, look, you know, Romeo tried this. And then we look over here and these guys, Pete Carroll tried this. So that's going to come back. Derrick Henry, I think, might have had the best stretch of his career he'll ever have again. And I think he'll remain valuable. But this is a guy that they were talking about potentially having to replace at the beginning of the season.
Yeah.
You know, like they were talking about making plans for after Derrick Henry. So they're just going to, the pendulum's going to swing back a little bit.
I think they got to where they got.
Yeah.
With one of the least replicable ways to do it.
Uh-huh.
Like you go, okay, here's how we got to the AFC title game. We pounded Derrick Henry 35 times a game for 4 straight weeks. Like, when's that going to happen again? You know what I mean? We did it with Ryan Tannehill playing 2 levels above anywhere, anytime he's ever played in his decade mm-hmm. in the league.
And they also did it with the play action was working extremely well for them. And one of the reasons it was working well, I think, was because they were doing it in a manner, in a style that was different than how they used it with Marcus Mariota. There just simply wasn't as much film. So when you start to see all the film and what do these plays look like and, you know, what are we anticipating, it's just a lot easier. I mean, so much as a defense in stopping an offense, you know, it's obviously a lot about scheme, but some of it is simply when you're watching film during the week, being able to visualize what's going on. This is what you're doing as a defensive back, as a defensive lineman, anybody during the week in film. You're watching film and you're visualizing, all right, how am I going to respond to that? How am I going to react to that? The really good guys close their eyes and think about it and do it like in real time mm-hmm. and think about how it's going to look and feel. So you're just getting more practice against that offense. If you don't have all that film to watch and you don't have the history with it, it's a lot harder to execute really fast and really hard on game day. So what happens in the offseason is you've got an entire offseason, all these OTAs, training camp and everything, and at various times you're watching little cut-ups of the Tennessee Titans. Then you get and you're playing next year, and you've already seen these guys a couple times, and everything just becomes a little bit faster. That's just above and beyond the X's and O's. Guys react faster because there's a familiarity there. So that's what Tannehill and the Titans have to worry
about
next year.
That's what they're up against, yeah. So the Texans are 8th on this list. It's a list of the 10 playoff losers this year, and they're ranked in the order that this particular writer, the writer on CBSSports.com, is named Sean Wagner Magoo. And this is what he says about the Texans. And this is going to lead me into something here. The Texans are ranked above the Titans because of one player, Deshaun Watson. Watson can't do it all by himself, which is why the Texans are still ranked near the bottom of this list, but he gives the Texans a chance. But the Texans are unlikely to win the Super Bowl because the team doesn't have enough resources to give him the help that he needs. It talks about barring any trades, they're not going to pick until the second round. They've got one pick in the top 100, and they've got issues on defense. The offensive line is revamped, but they were still not great at pass blocking. Watson makes the Texans the favorites in the AFC South because he's the best quarterback in the division, but unless he gets some help, he can't be expected to win a Super Bowl entirely on his own. I thought about this earlier when we were talking about O'Brien, Seth, earlier in the show. And I think this is what it boils down to for me. One of the reasons why I am not happy right now is because the Deshaun Watson experience is being a little bit ruined for me right now.
Mm-hmm.
We should be celebrating Deshaun Watson, that the Texans have Deshaun Watson, that he's one of the, to me, one of the best quarterbacks in the league from skill set, mentally, physically, the whole nine yards. And because of what's gone on with this team, we can't fully enjoy the Deshaun Watson experience in two ways. One, I do agree with the people that are saying that the way Bill O'Brien calls games, the way the offense is set up, just sort of the way O'Brien goes about things offensively, does not fully take advantage of Deshaun. Whether it's with the way the offense is put together from a personnel standpoint or the way the play calling is, I don't feel like we're getting maximum Deshaun. Some of that's Deshaun's fault, but some of it is due to the head coach and the play caller. The other thing that ruins the Deshaun Watson experience for me is this, that I think there's a lot of people right now that feel there should be change with the head coach or within some level of the organization beyond just the roster. And the problem is that Deshaun Watson is so good that they're never going to be bad enough to where if you have a super patient ownership,
right,
they're going to be inclined to make change. Deshaun Watson in some ways might be his own worst enemy from being a little bit too good to allow the team to get to a point where you got to really take a super critical look at the head coach and the general manager,
right,
and all the things that go into it.
Yeah, he takes a 6-10 team and makes them a 9-7 team.
Yeah,
he takes a 7-9 team and turns it into a 10-6 team.
And I will root for Deshaun Watson until he's never a Houston Texan anymore. But inherently, by rooting for Deshaun Watson, you're rooting for the team to be at a level. You're rooting for the team to be at a level that they can't achieve right now.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, the level that he can achieve is high enough to where the things that need to get changed won't get changed for them to achieve
even
higher.
So what you're basically saying is that it's all Deshaun's fault. That,
in a weird way, I am. And that's what I'm saying. That's my point is, like, I can't fully enjoy the Deshaun Watson experience.
If Deshaun Watson were to get injured and miss the entire season and they went 2-14, then the problem there is that O'Brien has the easy excuse of, well, I was playing with AJ McCarron.
He got an extension after going 4-12 when Deshaun got hurt a couple years ago.
There were trade rumors about him after going 4-12.
Right.
Like, oh my gosh, you can't lose. It's crazy how these trade rumors pop up with some of these coaches sometimes. He got an extension for God knows why. It's just because Deshaun Watson was injured. And oh my gosh, you got to have the guy that helped develop Deshaun Watson apparently at some point.
For six games. Yeah. Yeah, so that's the thing. I think as I'm trying to process all the things that are bothering me about the Texans right now, when we were talking about Deshaun earlier, that's when it hit me. I'm like, I am bothered because I can't fully enjoy the Deshaun Watson experience.
I think it's as simple as this. It's that Bill O'Brien he just 100% has to be on the hot seat right now because he has his franchise quarterback, and he's had him for two full seasons now. He had him his rookie year. He had him for two full seasons. And they weren't a top offense in either of those years. If you have a guy, so then it becomes either, all right, who's the problem here? Is it Deshaun or Bill O'Brien? And I think in a lot of ways, it's still Deshaun. Deshaun needs to keep advancing as a quarterback like anybody in his third year does. Like Andrew Luck, when he was in his third year, had to keep getting better. The question is, all right, is Bill O'Brien the guy to do it? People feel comfortable that he is the guy? I don't think a lot of people do.
No.
And I think, you know, I'll go back to Orlovsky saying that a lot of people around the NFL think that Bill O'Brien is holding Deshaun Watson back. And that it's not because we know that Deshaun does not lack for intelligence. We know that he does not lack for athletic ability. We know that he does not lack for leadership qualities. He lacks none of those things. At some point, all right, how is he going to take that next step? He has talent around him on offense. He just drafted offensive linemen. There are no more excuses. There are zero excuses for the offense not to be a top 10 DVOA offense next year.
Yeah.
So the DVOA is just an easy way to rank how teams are adjusted for schedule and everything. If they're not a top 10 offense next year, I don't see how you can possibly move forward with Bill O'Brien as your head coach / GM. There will be, if you keep O'Brien, if they don't do that next year and you keep O'Brien, you may as well be saying, all right, well, we don't believe in Deshaun Watson. You know, and at that point, you better draft another quarterback because it's either or at this point in my mind, and I believe in Deshaun Watson.
Yeah, or you don't believe in results.
Right.
Like, it is what it is. The 2 years where Deshaun Watson has played a full season, 2018 and 2019, to use the metric DVOA, which Seth just mentioned, footballoutsiders.com, it's their efficiency measurement. I think it's the most accurate measurement for how good or defense can be.
It's interesting.
Real quick, Seth, those two full seasons, 2018, the Texans were 21st. 2019, the Texans were 17th in offense.
Yeah.
Overall.
In offense.
Not even in the upper half.
Remember, Romeo Crennel just got fired. He's typically at a top 10 this last year. The year in which Jadeveon Clowney was traded away, and I understand if you didn't want to sign him long-term, whatever, but just to, for what you're up against, the year in which Jadeveon Clowney was traded away, right before the season, mind you, and J.J. Watt was injured for most of the year, that's the first time Romeo Crennel hasn't had a top 10 DVOA defense. He's the one that got fired. But Bill O'Brien, the quasi-offensive coordinator, the quasi-GM, the quasi-lord of football, he remains, obviously. Of course he does.
Have there been any changes on the offensive side of the ball since the season ended?
No, everything's fine, Sean. Yeah, everything's groovy. Don't worry about it.
17th, baby.
Yeah, you gotta. I don't know what you. There's nothing to see here.
Yeah.
By the way, I don't know if I mentioned this or not, but they traded 2 first-round picks for Laremy Tunsil.
That's right. They did.
A mediocre offense. To remain a mediocre offense.
Seth, I don't know if you noticed, but 21st last year and 17th this year, they moved up 4 notches.
I don't think you're understanding how hard it is to be 8-8 in this 8-8 league where everything's designed to be 8-8.
It's really hard to win football games in a league where half the teams win every single week.
Should we give credit to Bill O'Brien for winning a lot of games despite not actually being that good as a football team? It's a really freaky, weird thing he's got this knack for doing of like ending up with a winning record despite scoring fewer points than your opponents did over
the course
of the year.
Is wild. Payne and Pendergast, Sports Radio 610. So have you seen this Kyle Shanahan video from the NFC title game, Seth?
I've seen it. I didn't listen to it. Okay. People have described it to me that I know the exact play in which it happened. It's really interesting.
Right. So it's towards the end of the game, and the 49ers are on a drive. It's third down, and the 49ers are on a drive. They're up by 14. They're on a drive where if Green Bay's able to get off the field, at the very least they get the ball back with about 5 or 6 minutes to go and they've still got a puncher's chance.
Yeah.
Instead, if San Francisco holds on to the football, they can go down, get some points, and end the game, which is ultimately what happened. But if you listen to this, I'll set this up, and I know this is radio, so I'm going to try to set this up visually as best I can. Kyle Shanahan, the video is shot literally from right next to him on the San Francisco sideline. The camera is facing out towards the field. And Shanahan is talking to one of the officials, I believe, probably the line judge. And the 49ers are getting ready to run the play, and Shanahan essentially tells the line judge exactly before the snap what is going to happen in terms of the way that Green Bay is going to defend George Kittle. He basically calls his shot on a pass interference penalty.
5 yard out route, 85 versus their guy. He's going to go inside and break out. He won't let him out. Watch.
Green Bay broke up the shutout, but San Francisco was still in control.
Redner just held him the whole way.
Two flags came down.
Which is exactly what happened.
Yeah.
Exactly what Kyle Shanahan said would happen did happen. So everybody's making a big deal out of that. There's people comparing it to when Sean McVay, you know, goes back and has his incredible recall on plays. Mm-hmm. Like, wow, look at Kyle Shanahan can see the future. Before it happened, Seth, are people making too big a deal?
It's not like he's Nostradamus for doing this or anything. He could tell what coverage Green Bay was going to be in, and he knew what play they were running, and he knew how he typically defends in that situation. They'd probably seen it earlier in the game, so I don't. They shouldn't be making as big a deal out of it because that's not actually what makes Kyle Shanahan so impressive.
Right.
There are a lot of coaches in the league that would do that, be able to do that. Kyle Shanahan, and I'll go back to just when Kyle Shanahan was a position coach here, and I remember talking to various guys about it, and Andre Johnson, about how, I actually talked to Andre Johnson about it last night, about how Kyle Shanahan was just so amazing at teaching you the finer points of the game because he'd grown up with Mike Shanahan as his father.
Mm-hmm.
He just flat out knows football. It's just incredible how good he is at teaching the nuances of the game. So these little things like this is just bread and butter for him. His real skill as a coach, I think, and as a coordinator isn't just the way he flat out coaches football. I think sometimes the word genius, I don't like it the way it's applied because it conjures up these images that somehow the real work of coaching is done on the grease board and like coming up with these magic playbooks like in Henry Winkler in that Adam Sandler movie.
Oh, the
Water
Boy.
Where it's much less about the actual plays as it is about getting guys to execute and make the right decisions on the field. And I think Kyle Shanahan is really, really good at that. And he knows he knows the way that they've been playing George Kittle, and he knows what's going to happen here. So my long answer is I'm saying, yes, people are overblowing this, but I don't want that to make it sound like I don't have respect for Kyle Shanahan. The reason I'm picking the 49ers in this game is specifically because I like Kyle Shanahan as a coach better than I like Andy Reid as a coach. I think Kyle Shanahan and the work that he does with players and the things that he did for Matt Ryan and the things that he'll eventually do for Jimmy Garoppolo are just amazing, you know, and so is Andy Reid. But Andy Reid has all these old foibles that I worry about from back, just his history of botching things in big games.
He's got a lot of game management skeletons in his closet.
That Pat Mahomes does his best to overcome.
Right.
Pat Mahomes bullies Andy Reid around a little bit and says, no, no, old fella, we're not going to do it this way. We're actually going to keep going up tempo. We're going to do all this. So, I feel like it's a little overblown just because it's the consistency with which Kyle Shanahan can do this stuff. That's the most impressive thing.
I think the coolest thing about it, and we're talking about this Kyle Shanahan video where he tells the line judge, hey, 85 for us is going to run outside. Watch, essentially paraphrasing, watch the Green Bay guy prevent him, you know, commit a penalty to prevent him from getting outside, which is exactly what happens. The thing that I like the most about it is the gamesmanship of it. The Kyle Shanahan, I got to believe, it was a fairly obvious penalty, but you never know. Maybe the line judge would have been looking somewhere else. At the very least, he got that line judge to focus on the part of the play where the game-changing penalty could be committed.
I would say, okay, and this is what I'll say about it, again, because it's kind of like when we're arguing about the Hall of Fame discussion with Eli Manning. I'm not saying that Eli's a bad quarterback, but somehow that's what it sounds like when you're saying he shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
This, I think a lot of high school coaches can do this. Like, I think a lot of high school coaches are listening to this and thinking, like, okay, I've been watching the game. I know how they're playing my best player. I can tell this, too. So, it's overblown, but I think that Kyle Shanahan is a brilliant coach.
Right.
This is not the thing that makes Kyle Shanahan a brilliant coach.
Yeah.
Just like, with Sean McVay. Sean McVay reciting the play-by-play on specific drives, it's a good parlor trick and everything, but that's not what makes him a good coach.
Yeah.
There are a lot of coaches that can do that. There are some brilliant coaches that maybe can't do that because they don't have, maybe their brain isn't organized the same way. Parlor tricks. As like Ryan Fitzpatrick's little kid doing that little math trick there. Like, it's an impressive trick. But the reason the kid, I'm sure Ryan Fitzpatrick's kid is genuinely extremely bright otherwise.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like a little parlor trick that did it for
him. How many NFL coaches have parlor trick level intelligence?
That's true, because that is the level.
Right?
Like, which guys don't? Which guys can't do a parlor trick?
What is Bill O'Brien's parlor trick?
I bet he can.
713-572-4667.
I bet he slams beer like a champ. I bet he's like a Tom Brady level of slamming a beer.
I think we saw his parlor trick on the TMZ video.
You suck too. His parlor trick is, no, I'm not going to show you a parlor trick.
That's right.
How's that for a parlor trick? How about I make you disappear, you little punk?
His parlor trick is verbally undressing somebody until he tells them, I'm not going to do any parlor tricks.
What's Belichick's parlor trick? Belichick already knows how much money you have in your wallet. Belichick has one of these kind of Jedi mind trick
Belichick's,
type of...
His parlor trick is getting you to take 50% of what your value is on the open market if you're a player.
Belichick is, he can name your top five psychological weaknesses.
Yes.
Belichick's trick is he'll talk you into giving away your game plan for the next week.
He probably could.
That's why I still have this sense that Belichick calls just to have a friendly chat with the guy he's playing that week. And in the course of 3 minutes, knows exactly what that guy is doing.
100%.
And the harder the opposing coach tries not to give up anything, he's giving up even more.
Do you know that you and Clint both agreed on the best place for Tom Brady to go play next year, not in New England?
I thought you were about to say the best place for tamales. The best place for Tom Brady. Yeah, that makes sense. We have similar minds about these kinds of things.
You guys both. I came up with seven places. And, of course, I was doing the afternoon on Tuesday. So, like the good, efficient radio host that I am, I repurposed like three or four topics just that I used with you. I just used them with Clint, so that was easy.
Yeah.
But this one I was interested in, especially because he's a quarterback. But ultimately, I had seven places. You nixed most of them, except for the one you were very excited about, same one he was, Tampa Bay.
Mm-hmm.
So...
And we worked our way through that.
We
kind of just
did
that. So we
it.
Came to it. It was like like a math problem. We showed our work.
We did.
And I couldn't come up with anything good until we got to Tampa Bay and my eyes just lit up.
It lit up.
And I almost feel like it makes sense even if you wanted to keep Jameis Winston around, what's Jameis Winston going to do? Cry about not getting to start over Tom Brady?
That's interesting. Are there teams out there? Is there a team out there that would sign Jameis Winston to a one-year deal just to see if they could iron out the turnover stuff?
Right. Wouldn't know, but I'm saying, but in Tampa, would you actually keep Jameis Winston but also bring Tom Brady in? Tom Brady might not like that, and he might not agree to that.
No, and I think Jameis, I mean, would he bring Jameis back as a highly paid backup? Like, someone may offer Jameis
some money.
Yeah, no,
that's my point. It's like, yeah, he can sit around and wait for a year or two and learn under Tom Brady until, because maybe you only get Tom for one more year. Maybe Brady just wants to, but there's also a chance, that Tom Brady comes to Tampa and ends up playing like seven more years.
I know. That's true. There's also a chance that, according to David Carr, your former teammate, that he would be taking the job that could belong to one Phillip Rivers. David Carr had four places Phillip Rivers could land. All of a sudden, Tampa Bay is a hot spot between you and Clint saying that Brady could go there, and or that you would recommend
Phillip Rivers could land in Tampa Bay. Okay,
well, he's moved to Florida.
Right.
Now,
I thought you meant that Tom Brady was going to land with the Chargers, and I thought myself, why on earth would he subject himself to that?
No, David Carr has a piece up here about Phillip Rivers. Phillip Rivers on the move. Four potential landing spots for the QB. Number one on the list: Tampa Bay Buccaneers.
This would be the question: if you're Bruce Arians, who do you want? Do you want Phillip Rivers or Tom Brady? Half of me thinks that he would actually weirdly prefer Phillip Rivers.
Why?
Because Phillip Rivers has more arm talent at this point, and and I think
Phillip Rivers is basically a redneck Jameis.
I think Phillip Rivers, it's what can you salvage with what he has left. So Bruce Arians, I think that Bruce Arians would be fascinated. He'd be fascinated to learn what he could from Tom Brady and to work with him. But I think Phillip Rivers people underestimate his intelligence as well. We saw him mic'd up, you know, when he was calling out the Texans defenses and identifying the mic and all that stuff and not falling for any of the chicanery. He's a really bright quarterback.
And reminding everybody how bright he was in between plays.
But I feel like
I saw you trying to do that.
The thing about Phillip Rivers is Phillip Rivers is like a good speed chess player. I would imagine, I don't know how chess works, but I know they play that little version where you have to like, you have like 30 seconds to make your move.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing there are people that are really good at that who aren't as good at the long form, where you have to sit around and be patient and everything.
Yeah.
I feel like Tom Brady's the kind that's good at sitting around and playing at the long game.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to an entire game plan and figuring out what's going on over the course of four quarters, and sometimes the first two quarters are just figuring it out and probing, I feel like Tom Brady has that kind of mind, where Phillip Rivers is a jam band versus Tom Brady is conducting a symphony.
It's a symphony, yeah.
So what's Bruce Arians? Bruce Arians, frankly, feels a little bit more like a Fish guy than Boston Philharmonic.
Yeah,
maybe he wants to be a little bit more about the Boston Philharmonic.
Maybe. The other three teams, two of them are the ones I brought up for Tom Brady. Two of them are in that group. Tennessee Titans, number two. Carolina Panthers, number three. Indianapolis Colts, number four. Two of the four teams that David Carr has there are AFC South teams. I'm going to tell you right now, Phillip Rivers does not scare me. If the Colts or the Titans sign Phillip Rivers, sweet. I think Phillip Rivers is shot. That's my estimation.
Tom Brady with the Titans, and we know they love to run the play action. They'll give him the support that they need. They might actually even further bolster their offense somehow
if Tom Brady gets there.
Yeah. Vrabel and Brady can talk the same lingo and the same dialogue right off the bat.
Yep.
That would be really interesting. And Arthur Smith also, the offensive coordinator for the – I'm surprised Arthur Smith isn't – starting to get talked about more as a potential head coach.
Yeah.
But, I if they had Tom Brady for 1 year. But they'd also be pushing Ryan Tannehill off to the side. That's that tough. This might be Mike Vrabel's hardest decision as a coach. And I know it's him and the GM. But figuring out, all right, if we bring Tom Brady in now, Ryan Tannehill's going to be off and gone. And are we missing the boat? I don't think they can take that risk. They got to play it out with Tannehill and see what they have.
God, how crazy is it that you're saying they got to play it out with Tannehill and just say no to
Tom Brady?
Tom Brady, that's crazy.
It feels a little bit like Schaub and Manning. Huh?
A little bit. Speaking of Manning, Eli is done. He's retiring on Friday. What were some of the things that people were saying about Eli Manning about the time that Peyton Manning still had not won? Back when the Manning brothers were still competing for the number of Super Bowls they'd won. We'll dig into that.
Somebody said Bill O'Brien's trick is, you know what? I had a better one prepared, but I don't have it right now.
Yeah,
I can't think of one right now.
He makes fourth and one plays disappear.
Do I have any timeouts left? Nope, I can't think of a good parlor trick.
Payne and Pendergast, Sports Radio 610. Hey, Jonesy, This doesn't deserve the breaking news sounder because I don't know how much of Houston cares. But I'm bringing this up because I do feel like some of Houston cares, and I feel like you will care deeply as a Philadelphia sports fan.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw across the ticker on the bottom of the TV screen in here, Bud Norris has signed a minor league deal with the Philadelphia Phillies. Bud Norris.
Oh,
folks.
Bud Norris. Hey, Bud, fellas, there you go.
Bud Norris. So let me use again.
Cheater?
Yeah. If they were cheating back then, they were doing a very poor job.
Bud Norris angry. Don't pay Jonathan Singleton. Bud
yes,
Norris,
right? Bud Norris angry about a lot of things.
But not, and it wasn't don't pay Jonathan Singleton. It was Jonathan Singleton, don't accept that money, even though you know your damn self that you're never going to make the major.
Bud Norris, noted pocket watcher of other players.
Yeah.
This is where I will again. I'm not going to say it's my mission because people are going to feel how they want to feel. I'm just telling you how I want to feel about things going on right now. I feel like we've hit the darkest of this recent patch here. We've kind of internalized the Astros' punishments. Everybody's getting ready to move on. The Texans have made a few moves. We'll see what happens in the draft and free agency. The Rockets won a game last night. So these dark clouds that were hovering over the city, I'm not going to say they're all gone, but there's a little bit of blue sky breaking through these clouds. So I am going to continue to remind people, through any means necessary, that we are not living in a horrible time right now. We're living in a rough patch for three, you know, average to great teams. And the reason I bring up Bud Norris is, one, to remind Jonesy that he's part of the Philadelphia organization now, Bud Norris. But remind people as well that back when things were really bad, not now when things are just temporarily bad, back when things were really terrible in this town sports-wise, Bud Norris was the highest paid player on the Astros at $3 million a year. In 2013, this isn't like 1985. In 2013, the Astros had a team where their highest paid player was Bud Norris. That's bad enough. He was making $3 million a year. That's even worse. The team as a whole was making like their payroll was like $18 million.
Right. Yeah, and it was
payroll was less than what George Springer is going
to
make this year.
And this is, as I was talking to some of the Astros folks at the Houston Sports Awards the other night, and I actually, because I told you, for one, I talked to Jeff Blum and I talked to Julie Morales, and I felt like I wanted to give them a pep talk, because I know that when they're traveling and visiting stadiums this year, it's probably going to be kind of tough at times. They're going to get some pretty aggressive treatment.
It'll be
fans.
Worse for Julia than it is Jeff, because Julia is like out.
Julia
be roving
out and
reporter.
About. She's
going
to have to deal with heckling, you know, and hopefully other people around will shame the
hecklers
and loudest and to be like, hey, maybe don't harass a woman in this day and age.
That's right.
Like at least loudly and on camera.
Yeah.
So maybe hopefully that'll help a little bit, but. What I was telling was that at home, at least, and around what we hear from our listeners is that even people that are upset about the Astros cheating are still, I feel like most of them are still very much supporting the Astros, and they're trying to move through this, and you're starting to get a little sick of hearing it from all these other fan bases. So I think it's going to be pretty good enough. There's going to be some things that are pretty good. The other thing is that we used to have debates and conversations about whether Jim Crane was ever going to be willing to spend money. He is now spending the third most money in Major League Baseball at a market size that is not nearly the same as it is with the New York Yankees or the LA Dodgers.
That's right.
So Crane, these questions about Crane and whether he was going to be willing to spend were largely, I mean, I wouldn't say the questions were unfounded because we just didn't know, but they've been answered. And it's, yes, he is willing to spend. Now, where they are is he looks like he's not willing to spend into the luxury tax. That's not as big of an issue in baseball as it is in basketball, simply because very few baseball teams are willing to spend into the luxury tax.
That's right.
Just the economics of it have just worked out that way. And I think it's easier with the analytics in baseball than it is in basketball to kind of figure out what you think the market rate is for certain players.
Yeah.
But it's not that he's cheap by any means.
No.
So the other big thing, the other positive is that the sanctions didn't touch the international system. And that's actually a big deal. I mean, you think about some of the things the Astros have been able to do with international players. There's a few pretty good ones on your team.
I was a little surprised.
Yeah.
I wonder if part of why where they punished the Astros in terms of developmentally was with the draft picks. And they took their first and second round picks in the MLB draft each of the next 2 years. I do wonder if they were trying, if MLB, part of that was certainly they're trying to punish the Astros for, you know, not just a punishment now in terms of Hinch and Luno, but trying some sort of punishment to make sure that it hindered the franchise in some way. I wonder if instead of hitting that, instead of the international stuff, was to make the punishment more consumable for the average fan.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Right, it placates people.
Yeah, because the average fan follows the NFL and the NBA draft, which are very much more high-profile drafts. Yeah. So MLB fan bases around the country can feel like, oh, they hear first and second round pick in two drafts, and they immediately go, wow, that sounds really significant. So
and
I wonder if that's
the
part
hardcore
of why they
baseball people that are more like, well, wait a second, but what about the international players? Right. How are you possibly,
it's a more complex thing to understand for the average
fan, so
how
it,
the
it
international
kind of,
stuff
it's
works.
It's the pound of flesh to keep the populace satisfied.
Yeah.
Which, and again, there is a feel to this, and I think there's a justifiable skepticism of, okay, how thoroughly is Major League Baseball really investigating these other teams? Mm-hmm. Or is it that they just wanted to show that, hey, we nipped it in the bud, and they're, and again, I don't want to make it sound like I'm rationalizing the Astros cheating or anything, but there is a chance that maybe the Astros are the sacrificial lamb, and there are other teams that did things that were just as egregious, and that they're going to get off scot-free because of it.
I can't wait to see what the Red Sox get for a punishment.
Yeah.
Because they're a true recidivist.
Right.
You know, I mean, they've been punished before.
Yeah.
So they,
and the Yankees as well. The Yankees have been punished before for technology.
Yeah, no, they have. They have. We know there's a punishment coming for the Red Sox.
We know for sure.
Yeah.
But there are other teams, there was a statement yesterday where Manfred said, hey, we've told the Red Sox that we're looking into anything interesting with these other teams.
Yeah, yeah. Trust me, I would like nothing more than for the Yankees to get hit with a big punishment.
Yeah.
And for somehow Gerrit Cole to get swept up in it.
If we're also looking at things to make you feel better, and again, we talked about this a little bit earlier in the show about, all right, what are the positives about potentially getting better on defense? What you hope is that Anthony Weaver makes a difference. And again, because I don't like blaming Romeo Crennel for why the defense wasn't good last year, but there is an argument that maybe Romeo Crennel, even when the Texans had the right talent there, kept them from becoming a top five defense or a really good defense. I would say, look, you have physical talent in the secondary right now. And Lonnie Johnson is one of those. I know it's not exciting to talk about Lonnie Johnson right now because he had some rough goes of it at various times as a rookie, but he had some good moments as well. Hopefully he takes a step forward. But you look at just a couple of the defensive backs that did the best in the league as rookies this year. Jamel Dean from the Tampa Bay Buccaneers.
Yeah.
I believe he was a fourth-round pick.
Yeah, I saw an article on Battle Red Blog that did a whole thing with the Texans' first three picks in last year's draft, who they took and who they should have taken. And the pick, I think it was, first of all,
here's a third-round pick. Jamel Dean was a third-round pick.
Right, they had one of the picks, either the Sharping or the Lonnie Johnson pick. Uh-huh. They had them as should have taken, I think it was the Lonnie Johnson pick because it was the same position. They had him, should have taken Jamel Dean.
Yeah.
You know, kind of thing. They could
the
do
Texans
it over
should have
again.
Taken Jamel
if they
Dean,
could have
yeah.
done it over again. Now, the nice thing is, they did say about the first round that if they could do it, if you did the draft over again, they should take Titus Howard still. So
right,
you feel good
right,
about that.
Yeah, that's a good.
Howard's going to work out, but go ahead with Dean.
Chauncey Gardner-Johnson, too, from the Saints.
Yep.
He had a really good year, too. He was a fourth-round pick. And I'm not doing that thing where I say, like, hey, why bother with a first-round pick when you can get a third-round pick?
Right. We know what the hit rates are.
It is right. Like, the chances of doing it are low, but you gotta do it. So with the second-round pick, whether it's another defensive back or what have you, there's room for growth on the defensive side of things. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily like, oh, wow, you don't have a first-round pick. How on earth are you going to improve?
Yeah.
One, the pick I always think about in terms of improving a pass rush is Michael Bennett when he went to the Seahawks.
Yes.
That was a very reasonable free agency signing. Like, not notable in terms of dollar signs or anything like that.
Impactful.
He was a very impactful player for them. Those guys are out there, but that's where the pressure is really on Bill O'Brien and the GM committee to figure that out, right? Who are the reasonable free agent signings that can make a big impact? You can't Aaron Colvin it this year.
No.
You can't afford an Aaron Colvin free agency signing.
That's a great way
to
put it, Seth. That's a great way to put it. So Eli Manning is retiring tomorrow. We're 2 hours and 47 minutes into the era of Payne and Pendergast in which we know about Eli Manning retiring. Are we tired of discussing whether Eli's a Hall of Famer yet?
I'm exhausted from it. I feel like it might have started his junior year in college.
Yeah.
Did he come out as a junior?
I can't remember if he left school early. I don't think he did.
Dirty, rotten quitter.
Peyton didn't.
No.
Peyton
was staying for 10, you know, he had a chance at a national championship and
That's
everything.
True. Yeah.
Eli was staying for Ole Miss.
Yeah.
I don't think they were.
They were decent when he was there.
Yeah, they were.
Yeah, they were decent. Yeah. They were decent when he was there.
Sorry, Ole Missians.
Pro Football Focus put up a poll. Is Eli a Hall of Famer? Do you think yes or no won the poll?
I bet 67% said no.
59% said yes.
No kidding, really.
Seth, I think his Hall of Fame candidacy, my sense, is it has more steam than we think.
I think you and I have angered a lot of people already this morning.
Have
just
we
by
really?
Both being kind of unanimously. Maybe we should have done the first take thing where before the show we would have
you
said like,
this side?
All right, I guess I'm against it.
Do you know how sheepishly I would be arguing on behalf of Eli? I'd be practically reading a statement. It'd be like reading an apology that I don't want to read.
You'd go ahead and sabotage yourself.
Yeah,
You'd be doing the hostage thing where in Morse code you'd be blinking out.
What?
You'd be blinking out mediocre as you were making an argument for him being in the Hall of Fame. He's not mediocre. You're above average. He was an above average quarterback.
I would say he was average and he had two great playoff runs. That's how I would count. Literally an exactly .500 record as a starting quarterback.
He's got
the
seventh most touchdown passes of all time, baby.
Yeah, because he was made out.
His stats the last 3 years. Yes, but baby.
And he was made out of that same fiber that one Brock Osweiler was made out of.
Yeah.
Where you can just hit him and beat him to a bloody pulp,
and he
doesn't leave a game.
That is actually a really good point.
So you buy durability as a part of the Hall of Fame pie?
Durability is an athletic trait. I feel like over time, if you're a quarterback and you've made that many consecutive starts until Ben McAdoo's it. Wait, was it McAdoo that benched him?
Yes.
That was one of his final acts as coach. That durability is an athletic trait, and he should be rewarded for it. Uh-huh. Not with a Hall of Fame, but with a Hall of... There should be
Hall of the Durable.
There should be another, like, in an even more nondescript suburb of Cleveland, Ohio. Or I guess Columbus is its own city, kind of.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a big college town.
No. Canton's just a random town in Ohio.
Columbus is actually kind of a nice little town.
You like it?
Yeah.
I've never been there before.
You know what helped? Fracking helped out Ohio, that area of Ohio a little bit. Yeah, when they were, and I don't think they're drilling as much in that region right now. But I remember when they started fracking in Ohio. All of a sudden, some of those lesser cities started getting a kind of a little boon from it.
I feel like you've got your next topic of conversation with the Marsh Brothers when we go to a basketball game with them.
Fracking in Ohio.
Fracking in Ohio, yeah. They're an oil
plus,
family.
I remember driving through Western PA at that time, too, and all of a sudden, like, some of these little Rust Belt towns.
It's true.
You drive through these little, like, if you've ever driven to Pennsylvania, it's a weird place because it's very mountainous or at least hilly, and every place feels like its own little isolated hamlet. Where you might disappear and nobody will ever find out about it. And the sheriff says nothing. All these little towns all of a sudden had brand new like brick roads made to look like the 1800s with gleaming new buildings and everything.
Yep.
And So anyway. So there's your
well just back to Eli real quick because we had a lot of people texting earlier trying to make some sort of case that there was a time where you could argue that Eli was the better of the two Manning brothers. And I'm thinking to myself, when the hell was that time?
I think that people sometimes had an argument that maybe Eli was better in the clutch because he just didn't care as much as Peyton cared. But the problem with that is if you look at Eli's record outside of those two Super Bowl runs, is that he was, in four seasons, he was 0-4 in the playoffs.
Yes.
In those non-Super Bowl runs, he was 1-done in the playoffs. So this myth of the Eli clutch in the playoffs thing, it doesn't quite bear out. What are we gonna do, like give him credit for I bet if he would have gone to the Super Bowl in those years, then he would have had a clutch moment in those games.
This makes me want to go back and watch the condensed version of all of the playoff games in the two Super Bowl runs for the Giants. You can watch a condensed version of a game on Game Pass in about 30 minutes. This makes me want to go back and watch the I guess what they win, four games in each of those playoff runs, because I think they were 9-7. They didn't get a bye in either of them. And that I will grant Eli as well. They won both of those Super Bowls, and it was a tough path to win both of those Super Bowls. So that is a check in Eli's favor that they were, well, in some ways, they were mediocre enough during the regular season to where he had to go on the road to go win those, to go on those playoff runs. They played in the wild card round each of those years.
Right.
So you're
going to hear, I guess it's going to be five straight years.
So fine, put him in the Hall of Fame.
I think it'll take a hiatus for at least a few years, right? I feel like the voters are just going to be, by 5 years from now, they're gonna get together in a room. I'm going to present this as my actual theory to John McClain, just so I can see him get irate about it. It's hard to make John angry, but if you question the nobility of the Hall of Fame voters, that'll do it.
Yes.
But I think, so I might just say, hey, John, I think by the time 5 years is up, you guys are going to be so sick of hearing it that you're all going to get together and you're just going to say, what the hell? Let's just do it. All right. I want to deal with it. Sound good? And then you'll go drink Manhattan.
Not going to happen. Not going to happen.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, There's joy in every journey.